Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is February 7, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for Bolshevism in Russia, installment number 7. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh. How are you doing?
Absolutely. I'm doing fairly well.
Good.
All right, so last week we left off with report 56, correct?
Yes, sir. We should be on report 57, on page 57.
All right. Would you like to begin, or shall I begin the reading?
Well, be my guest.
Number 57, interviews with returned British subjects. Mr. A left Petrograd in November. He stated that production was practically at a standstill and in most favorable cases has decreased 50%. So if that's the best, then we'd hate to see the worst. We've already covered that in some instances. It was at a total standstill.
Right. And you know, I looked online today for economic data on the Bolshevik regime in the Soviet Union in the 20s. And that was my specific, you know, I did a few queries on Google and on Ask.com. And I couldn't come up with anything that I could trust. And I checked the Google searches. I checked like the first 30 pages, right? I couldn't come up with anything I could trust. And I just want to give two real short quotes that demonstrate the range of opinions on the economy in Russia, both, you know, around the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, from various so-called scholars. And I couldn't get my hand on this one article because it's behind a membership thing. But this guy, M.S. Conroy, in an article, Renovating Russia, the Human Sciences and the Fate of Liberal Whatever, he says, Russia's economy was robust in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And I'll leave it at that, because I don't have much more than that. But another so-called scholar on a website called RutledgePolitics.com, he says that the pre-revolutionary Russian economy was backward and stagnant. So we have one scholar saying that it was Russia's economy was robust, and another scholar saying it was backwards and stagnant.
Do any of them ever cite any data, such as what this document shows?
Well, I couldn't get my hands on the articles because they're behind, I wasn't signing up and paying dues for any professional association to download an article. But all of the articles I could get my hands on, I didn't trust any of them. That they all came from the Judeo attitudes that pervade academia today. They all seem to be coming from that angle, and I wouldn't trust one of them.
All right. Okay. He stated that production was practically at a standstill and in most favorable cases has decreased 50%. The factories are run by committees. A committee composed of Mensheviks produces a fair amount of work, but a committee of Bolsheviks gives a wholly unsatisfactory output. The committees were formerly elective, but the Bolsheviks now co-opt their own members without consulting the workpeople, and members who do not agree with the Bolsheviks are voted off. The committees are, in fact, entirely political, and there is a great increase of bureaucracy. Doesn't it sound like today's unions?
Well, absolutely. It's today's unions are the union system that's built up in this country, especially since the Depression, is Bolshevism-like.
Discipline is bad, and the men are frequently 1 or more than a half hours late. The responsible members of the committee do not understand the needs of the mill, and the Bolsheviks object to paying technical men. In May 1918, an attempt of the committee to form their own organization was rigorously suppressed. Mr. B, who has lived in Russia all his life, left Moscow on the 8th February and was interviewed at the Foreign Office on his arrival and supplied the following information. Shall I go ahead with food conditions?
Well, read food conditions. That's okay.
Okay.
I just want to remark, you know, the Bolsheviks object to paying technical men. In other words, they don't want to pay anybody for their skills that they've acquired. You know, they don't, if you have special skills, they don't want to pay you for it. They don't, the workman is not worthy of his wage in the Bolshevik system. No matter what skills you have or no matter what you're able to do, you only deserve the same pittance of a salary that everybody else has. And that seems to me that, yeah, you know, the Jewish plan for the American economy was to move all our factories to China in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second place, to take all the skilled labor, like computer programmers and designers and developers, and to teach these Pakistanis and these Indians and these other South Asian peoples that'll work for $7 an hour, to teach them to those people so that they would put the skilled labor here out of business.
And they don't really care how much expense an individual has incurred to gain expertise. They don't want to pay that individual anything.
Well, right. They want to pay everybody $7 an hour is what it comes down to, just base subsistence. In other words, the only people under Bolshevism is Judaism. And under Judaism, the only people that are allowed to have any money are Jews. That's what it boils down to. Everything else is just a false front. All this political talk, all these isms, all these ideologies mean nothing in the end. In the end, here we go, the benefits of office. I'm reading from Judaism and Bolshevism, and that was written by A. Homer in 1933. The benefits of office under the Bolshevik regime have been reaped by the Jews. The number of official appointments that have bestowed upon Jews during the Soviet regime is entirely out of proportion to their percentage in the state. And 2 million Jews had government positions out of what they claim to be 8 million Jews in the country. And over a third of the Jews in Russia have become officials. And the Jews were the only ones that were holding any property.
And they were also a protected class.
Anti-Semitism in Russia by 1933... And I'm still quoting from Homer, is now classed as counter-revolutionary and is punishable by death. And they used nationalization to loot the country, to loot the entire country of its wealth. And basically it boils down to the fact that under Judaism, the Gentiles get nothing and the Jews get everything.
In this country, they're using eminent domain.
Well, right. They're using a lot of devices in this country. But that's the Talmud. And wherever you have Jews, you're going to have the Talmud. You're going to have the principles of the Talmud. That's what it boils down to. And everything else is smoke and mirrors. All of the labels they like to put on political and economic ideologies, is smoke and mirrors. It boils down to one thing. Jews get and they get from Gentiles. And they get everything they can from Gentiles. That's what it boils down to.
All right.
Okay, food conditions. Food conditions is going to be interesting. The food conditions are getting worse and worse every day, and it is now practically impossible to obtain enough to eat. Yeah, you know, I read a paper today online. I mean, it turned my stomach, and I probably should have saved it, but it said that it was the Civil War in Russia, which really didn't end until the last White Army surrendered in 1922 and 1923 in the East. The Civil War in Russia destroyed Russian industry and food production. That's what this article tried to put forth. But
that's false.
It was Bolshevism that destroyed industry and food production. And it's perfectly clear in contemporary accounts. Okay. The food conditions are getting worse and worse every day, and it is now practically impossible to obtain enough to eat. People are dying of starvation everywhere. A few months ago, it was possible for the townspeople to buy food from the peasants down in the villages. But they are unable to do this now, as the peasants will not take money for any food that they may have to sell. The money is worthless. Everything is done by exchange. Money is no use to the peasants, but clothes and instruments are valuable. So the exchange system is used everywhere. They're operating on barter because the money's worth nothing.
And I'm seeing that
we might be doing that here soon.
Well, I'm already bartering on a daily basis for things with, you know, ammunition and other things that people are having difficulty obtaining.
Well, there you have it. Okay, Moscow, the following are the most recent prices of food. And I really do wish that we had something from 1913 to compare this to. Moscow, 1 pound of bread, 16 rubles. A pound of potatoes, 6 rubles. A pound of butter, 100 to 120 rubles. So a pound of butter is worth like 8 times what a pound of bread is worth, right?
Well, don't we know from what this says that since Russia was the main exporter of food to Western Europe prior to World War I, the food prices had to be very cheap. Otherwise, people wouldn't have bothered to export them if they could sell them domestically at 10 times what they get on the foreign market.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's clear. A pound of lard, 85 to 90 rubles, 18 times a pound of potatoes. Oil, 45 to 55 rubles. A pint of milk, 12 rubles. A pound of meat, 30 to 35 rubles. A pound of pork, 65 to 75 rubles. One cat is sold for 6 rubles. So I guess they were eating cat, and a pound of dog's meat was 5 to 7 rubles. I guess they were reduced to eating cats and dogs, and that's well it's common in China, but I wouldn't expect it in Western Russia.
Maybe the restaurants were just catering to their new Chinese masters.
Yeah, right. Well, they did have the Chinese. The Bolshevik army was loaded with Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
There are 3 food categories in Moscow now instead of 4, but even the category people cannot get all the food they are entitled to receive. Certainly, the first category ought to receive a half a pound of bread per day, and the second, 3/8 of a pound, and the third, 1/8 of a pound. Wow. Also, about 1/2 to 1 pound of fish a month, which was usually not fit for consumption. 1 1/4 to 1 1/2 pounds of oil a month, which they use as a substitute for butter, and about 1/2 a pound of soap a month. The above is all that could be obtained, even by category people. No fats of any description were obtainable. Mr. B himself sold a pound of soap for 35 rubles. In spite of the appalling conditions prevailing everywhere, the Kremlin is well supplied with all kinds of food. A servant of the house where Mr. B stayed had a brother in the Kremlin, and he told her that there was an abundance of ham, white bread, well, ham, and all the Bolsheviks were Jews, right? White bread, butter, sausages, etc.
They just requisitioned it all at gunpoint, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Disease. Right. Typhus is rampant. I'll read disease. Typhus is rampant everywhere and is getting worse every day. There is also a lot of typhoid fever about, but worse than this, glanders is now spreading among the people. The Bolsheviks are afraid of this terrible disease spreading far and wide. I don't know why they'd be afraid of it. They should invite it. They're killing everybody anyway. So they simply shoot any person suffering from this complaint. There are no medicines there by which they can attempt to cure the people. And there is, of course, a great shortage of doctors. Yeah, they shot all the doctors. Mr. B thinks that there are more cases of glanders in Moscow than anywhere else. I'd like to read a quick paragraph from an article. And this is from the other Holocaust, the terror famine in the Ukraine, Peter J. Lorden. And this was published in the Bonds Review in 1996. And we should probably cover this entire article one night.
All right.
And the Ukrainian famine. And he quotes from many even very noted academic scholars like Harvard's James Mace and several other, Wassily Frischenko's The Ukrainian Holocaust of 1933, Miron Dolat's Holocaust by, and that was published in 1983, Miron Dolat's Execution by Hunger, The Hidden Holocaust, and that was published in 1985, and Robert Conquest, The Harvest of Sorrow, and that was published in 1986, and they're all popular academic historians. and this is a quote from this article. After the massacre of Ukrainian leaders ordered by Lenin, who in 1918 offered his thugs a cash bounty for every landowner and priest they hanged, the 1921 to 22 famine, caused by grain exportation, killed millions more. Leon Trotsky was then heading the Red Army, with General R.P. Eidemann as his grain-grabbing deputy. Said Trotsky, "That rich granary is ours. The brutal means used to secure it, along with an anti-nationalist campaign which saw the Ukrainians shot dead on a street merely for speaking their own language, caused such a drop in production that famine appeared in other parts of the Red Empire. Fearing a general loss of control, the Bolsheviks had to invite foreign aid relief. Even then, they insisted, through spokesman Maximovich Litnov, that food relief go only to other parts of the empire, not to Ukraine."
You said that guy's name was Eidemann?
Yes.
It almost sounds like Idumean, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. General R.P. Idumean. Eidemann. And it does sound like a it sounds German, but it sounds Hebrew too to me.
Mm.
And that's, I have reasons for that. That's that E-I-D-E word. It's actually it can mean a well or an eye. Oh, okay, go on.
Are you done with your diseases report?
Yeah.
And I read on Wikipedia about glanders. They say that the German army was spreading glanders all across Russia with artillery barrages. I don't believe that, do you?
Absolutely. That's absolutely ridiculous.
All right. Fuel shortage.
Well, that's why we call it Jew Wikipedia. And that was probably some Jew that wrote that on Wikipedia. It's all propaganda. That whole, you have to really be careful about what you select from Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. Fuel shortage. The people are suffering intensely from the cold as there is practically no wood available. Only 3.5 feet of wood is allowed a month for one flat, and even this the people have to fetch themselves from the railway stations. The price of wood in the Nizhny Novgorod is 200 rubles a fathom, official price. If bought from outside in the markets, it is about 500 rubles. The average heat of a room is only 43 to 45 Fahrenheit. The fuel question is much worse in Petrograd than it is in Moscow. The reason for this is that most of the Petrograd houses have central heating, and when the pipes get out of order, as they invariably do, there is no possibility of ever having them mended.
No, when there's no heat in pipes, they freeze. And when they freeze, they burst because the ice expands. And if you have a water, you know, a radiator oil furnace water or gas furnace water heating system, and you one winter with water in those pipes, if you don't drain your system, your pipes are going to burst. And you're just, the house, you may as well burn it. You have to rip out all the piping and put an all new, an entire new heating system. And with some old houses, it might be easier just to rebuild the house. Okay, factories and workmen. All the workmen are anti-Bolshevik in reality. Now somebody, I explained on a program a few days ago, I think it was on the open forum last Thursday, that 80% of the Bolshevik proletariat was Jewish. And he jumped up and down and screamed that the proletariat was the working class. But I didn't say the proletariat, I said the Bolshevik proletariat. Because most of the working class, they weren't signed on with the Bolsheviks.
And if they were, it was only to get food or because they were being held at bayonet point.
Absolutely. They were held at bayonet point, their families were held at bayonet. We have seen in these reports that 90% of the workers in many of the factories deserted the factory and were nowhere to be found. They sure as hell weren't signed on with the Bolsheviks. Okay. All the workmen are anti-Bolshevik in reality, though many of them have to work under Bolsheviks in order to live. Mr. B gave 5 to 10%. Now, that's just what I just said, and that's based on but what we had read in earlier reports. Mr. B gave 5 to 10% as his estimate of the number of Bolsheviks out of the whole population of Russia. The Bolsheviks pay the workmen very well. But as the cost of living has increased so tremendously, their wages are not nearly high enough to enable them to live comfortably, even were they able to obtain food. Roughly speaking, the workmen get 15 to 20 times as much as they used to. And the cost of living has gone up to anything between 300 and 1,000 times as much as it was before the revolution. The Bolsheviks employ very high-handed methods with the factories. If the workmen strike, the factory is closed, the leaders are generally arrested, and sometimes they are even shot. At the Sokolnitsky Works, repairing trams, etc., so it repairs on buses and trucks. Trams, I think, in England are delivery trucks or tractor trailers. At the Sokolnitsky Works in Moscow, the workmen went on strike because the Bolsheviks said they were not turning out the proper amounts of work. As a result of this, the factory was simply closed down, and the following notice was put in the paper. In consequence of the falling off of production in the Sokolnitsky Works, it was closed down by order of the government. All this proves that the workmen's committees have no real power, as the Bolsheviks just do what they like without even consulting the committees. At S, where Mr. B was working, I guess they don't want to give the name of the factory, huh? The Bolsheviks wanted to inaugurate a demonstration on the 25th October, 1918. In order to get the men to attend a demonstration meeting, the Bolsheviks promised a free dinner to all who went and looked upon those who refused as saboteurs. This, in the end, practically amounted to forcing the men to join the demonstration, because there was no food otherwise, right? There were not many factories working in Russia now. Most of them have had to close down on account of the fuel shortage. The few factories that remain only work about 3 days a week, but the workmen are paid full wages. Often a factory has to be closed for weeks at a time owing to lack of fuel and raw material. During this time, the workmen are paid half wages.
All right. Political questions. The people have no interest at all in politics, the only topic of conversation being food. Everyone would welcome Allied intervention. In fact, anything would be preferable to the Bolshevik regime. Mr. B does not think that many troops would be required, as the Red Army is of small account, and directly they got there, it would go to pieces. In fact, the only reason why the officers stay in the army is because the Bolsheviks threaten to shoot their wives, mothers, or sisters if they desert. Mr. B has spoken to officers, the addresses of whose families had been taken down by the Bolsheviks for this reason. In Moscow, the Menshevik paper, Vyprovod, was allowed to reappear for a few days, but it was soon suppressed. It then appeared later under the name of Vegzda Vyprovod, Always Forward. The Izvestia still attacks the Mensheviks in spite of the so-called agreement with the Bolsheviks have made so much use of for propaganda abroad. So was there really a conflict between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, or was it just one Jew arguing over which Jew should be in charge?
Well, basically, I believe that's what it boiled down to. And I'm sure that the Bolsheviks didn't eliminate the Mensheviks. I mean, they may. It seems like they killed a few of their leaders.
But they basically just sidelined the membership of the Mensheviks, killed a few of their leaders, but they were never eliminated as a class. They weren't given the same treatment that the small peasant landowners were given.
Well, right. They were still Jews, and they were still, for the most part, and they were still socialists, for the most part. They were only, you know, Satan's house divided against itself.
And that's why that Dutch ambassador said that no help should be given to any of the other social revolutionaries, because the outcome would be the exact same.
That's exactly what he said. That's a very good observation. That's an excellent observation. That's exactly what he said, that it had to be stamped out and no help should be given to any other socialists, because the outcome certainly would have been the same. I think the Mensheviks were mad at the Bolsheviks because the Bolsheviks got the most funding from Wall Street bankers. and the German government. So they were the most successful. And if the Mensheviks had gotten that funding from the Wall Street bankers and the German government, they probably would have won out. But the result would have been the same.
It would have been the Menshevik Revolution instead of the Bolshevik Revolution.
Right. This is a good time to read from the Bloody Red Streak, a paragraph by the Bloody Red Streak by Trefor David. It was written in 1951. It was written when Trefor David was a fairly elderly gentleman because he served in World War I as an infantry soldier. Communism is a Jewish confidence trick. Communism is, in fact, a confidence trick whereby Jews acquire a nation's wealth by pretending to nationalize it for the working classes. Communist leaders themselves make no bones about this, after they get into power, of course. For instance, Matyas Rakosi, a Jew communist dictator of Hungary today, of an all-communist cabinet of five Jews whose sole Gentile, Laszlo Rajic, was hanged for anti-Semitism. A clue as to what might happen to the Gentile stooges Pollitt, Gallagher, Cox, Alf, Davies, and Horner. Plainly stated that this communist Hungarian leader, Matyas Rakosi, plainly stated as recently as the 31st of May, 1949, in a violent attack on the Hungarian working class for slackness. Now, we just saw that, right, in 1918, that socialism does not imply equality. And he jeered at them for foolishly supposing that the shares of the factories should be taken over and divided among themselves. Of course not. The Jews are going to end up with all the factories. And you know, Yeltsin's Russia proved that, right? A report of this speech can be found in the Times on the 3rd of June, 1949. In other words, before the Communist Revolution, the Jews say they will nationalize everything and give aid and give all the profits to the workers, I'm sorry, my mouse was in the way, and also make everyone equal. But after the Communist Revolution, they say the same thing as Rakosi said above and attack the workers for being suckers and slackers. Note, socialism is the same name, is the name given to the regime in Communist Russia and in all communist countries. Communists deliberately tell workers that the ideal of communism will take many years to attain. They do this so as to dangle a kind of carrot in front of the workers to spur them on to work for a vague utopia which is always just around the corner. In another 1,000 years, the Jews will still be telling the Russian workers that the paradise of communism is just around the corner. Jews, of course, hate real communism or socialism, which we define as the greatest possible diffusion of wealth. Hence, their hatred of Hitler, who introduced profit sharing in his factories. It's amazing. It's amazing that the average American will never, ever see this. General conditions. Back to the Russian number one report. To take a cab to the station costs 120 rubles, and even at this price, it is very difficult to obtain a cab at all. The terror is not so bad as it used to be, but this is merely because the people's spirit is quite broken, and they do not dare to offer opposition.
All right. Education. Students of the high schools do not pay any fees, and any boy or girl of 16 years of age is allowed to enter the universities without showing any certificates, so that if a boy is unable to read or write, he can still go to the university. This offer of education does not appeal to the working class very much, and it is mostly the intelligentsia who take advantage of this opportunity. In spite of the Bolsheviks' so-called efforts to promote education, nothing is being accomplished, and things are going from bad to worse. They have instituted workmen's clubs where the workmen can go and listen to lectures, but the only reason why any man attends is because a cup of tea and a slice of bread is usually supplied sometime during the lecture. In the same way, the only reason why children go to school is to get the breakfast that is given there.
A journey of this Mr. B to England. Mr. B came to England with 12 other Englishmen. So he's an Englishman working in Russia. But I don't think we were told that before. And they had to go through some very trying ordeals before getting out of Russia. They were packed in two cattle trucks, and it took them 68 hours instead of 12 to get from Moscow to Petrograd. They had to do their own stoking and find their own fuel, and they also had to feed the engine driver. During the journey, one Bolshevik woman told Mr. B that all the railway men ought to be shot as they were hostile to the Bolsheviks. Between the big stations, only two trains run a day, one in the morning and one at night. The whole question of transport is exceedingly bad. Mr. C, formerly with Tegan Company, and then with the Moscow branch of the Anglo-Russian Commission, left Russia on the 21st of January. It doesn't say anything about him, though.
You want me to handle factories and workmen?
Yeah, this is Mr. C's report.
Okay. Factories and workmen. All factories nationalized, only about half of them working. Men all anti-Bolshevik. Very discontented with conditions of life and with the working of the factories. Conditions getting worse and worse every day. Great many of the men have gone to the country as it is practically impossible, to live in the towns. Mr. C, after leaving Anglo-Russian Commission, went to the factory where he used to work to seek employment, but the factory had been nationalized and they refused to employ him, saying he was a counter-revolutionary because he was an Englishman. At one time, Mr. C lived near cotton mill belonging to Al. All the workmen there are against the Bolsheviks and very discontented, but they had to go on working for the Bolsheviks in order to live. Factory works about 3 days a week on a six-hour day. Often have to stop work for a week or two because there is no fuel or no cotton left. Have to wait until new supply comes in. Very often, about 10 factories combine and work under a common directorship. I almost said dictatorship. It's probably the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
This is done in order that one factory may exchange with another whatever is wanted. If one of these factories is closed down, the village members of the other factories are discharged and the men from the old factory employed in their places. In Petrograd, more attempts to strike than in Moscow. This is because in Moscow, the workmen are more under the power of the government, and they do not dare to strike. Even if they did, there is nothing to gain by it, for the government would simply stop their wages, discharge a good many, and probably cancel their bread cards. And more than likely, they'd probably all be shot, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. And on that note, I'd like to quote another paragraph from The Bloody Red Streak by Trevor David. No trade unions as we know them in Russia. It's the heading. And this is, the trade unions are used here by socialists really to just to break down the fabric of the nation and to break down the industrial strength of the nation. The Jew is hindered under democracy in his lust for maximum profits by the trade unions, who protect the worker and enable him to bargain for a share of the wealth available. Under communism, the function of the trade unions is simply reversed. Instead of protecting the workers against exploitation, it now acts as an instrument of the exploiting communist state. The Jews, and he has a parenthetical statement here, and that is, he's describing the exploiting communist state as the Jews, Kaganovich, Beria, Rakasi, Parker, and the rest. End of parentheses. To crush the workers, to extend hours of work to a maximum, to reduce wages to a minimum, to squeeze the last ruble of profit out of them. Further, the peculiarly communist technique of depriving workers and civilians of their civil rights under the slightest pretext, and then using them as slave labor, has enabled the Jewish rulers of Russia to build up the greatest profit-making force ever known in history. 20 million slave laborers who are paid no wages at all. Hence, most Jews back communism, not democracy. Well, I guess because only a few Jews own the companies here. Trade unions are kept on under communism for three reasons. One, as an instrument already in the factories, of the Jewish ruling class now to screw down the workers. Two, for the Jews to swipe for themselves political levies paid in by trusting trade unionists. Well, that's what they do here. And maybe in Trevor David's time, the unions were different in the West. And three, to fool the workers into believing they have a semblance of protection. All strikers are, of course, shot under communism. Okay, under the Russia number one report, Moscow. In Moscow, all shops are closed, with the exception of Soviet shops. All hotels taken up long ago by Red Guard detachments, etc. Nothing can be purchased from the shops without a ticket or an order, and this ticket can only be obtained by a Soviet worker, and even he has to go from one place to another before the ticket is legal. First, he has to get a ticket from his factory, then he has to go to his trade union, and so on, before he is entitled to buy anything. An ordinary man is unable to purchase anything. Fur coats, which had been requisitioned by the Soviet, were sold at the Soviet shops for, say, 200, 300, or 400 rubles. So that's a good deal. They steal your coat, they put it in their store, they sell it to me, and then they steal it from me and put it in the store and sell it back to you. The next day, the same fur coats were sold down in the thieves' market for about 7,000 rubles.
Well, there's a few corporate practices I'd like to discuss real quick. Just one that happened in Ohio a few months ago. The Ohio Main Energy Company, First Energy of Ohio here, they announced that they were going to send out 2 high-efficiency light bulbs to all their consumers in northeastern Ohio, and they were going to bill us $21 to $25 for these 2 light bulbs that retailed for $250 each at Walmart, and that it would reduce our electrical use by about 20 to 30% over the first year, and yet the state authorized them to continue billing us for the electricity that we would have been using, but we're no longer going to be using due to the savings of the energy efficiency bulbs. That way they wouldn't lose any profits. So they were going to bill us 10 times what the light bulbs are worth, and then continue charging us as though we were still using the electricity that we were no longer using. That has to be a Jewish scam, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, there's no doubt. But
there was a huge public uproar, and people basically said that if they were delivered all those light bulbs, they were just going to throw them at the side of the factory or throw them at the corporate headquarters. And they basically received probably 100,000 plus calls, and they aborted the plan. But it sounds like something right out of Bolshevist Russia. They steal your coat, sell it, then they steal it from whoever bought it, and then they sell it back to you.
That's what they do. They're Jews. They'll make a profit on every transaction, and when they don't have enough transactions, they create some. Mr. C sold a very old suit. Privately is selling, publicly is forbidden, for which he got 600 rubles. Services are not held in the church because there is no fuel to heat the building. As there are only a few people left to attend services, the priest holds them in his own house. When Red Guards are sent from Moscow to the front, there is often a row at the station and guns are taken from them. When they eventually arrive at the front, often only half of the original number present, the rest having escaped. The Red Guards are quite content to receive good pay, etc., but they are not anxious to fight. Well, that's, you don't see too many Jews on the front line anyway. Theaters still running very well. Actors are greatly privileged, being placed in the first category, etc. Well, that's how they treat them here, right? And most of the actors are Jews.
Absolutely.
Bookshops go on.
I was going to say they contribute nothing substantial to society.
Absolutely not. They're just parasites sucking off society. You know, in ancient Rome, and I have to mention this, and this is discussed by the Roman historian Tacitus. In ancient Rome, actors were the lowest class of society. They were the least paid, and they weren't even allowed to vote in Rome in the first century. So that's you're paying somebody to be an actor. He's not going to make a lot of money. I'm sorry.
Well,
you're paying somebody that enjoys playing with themselves is basically what you're paying for.
They're pretending to be something or somebody that they're not.
Well, right. And Jews are just experts at that, aren't they? That's why they're such good actors.
They pretend to be us, and yet they get their people immortalized for, you know, all time. They get to go put their handprints and their footprints in at that place in Hollywood on the sidewalk, and that's basically a form of idolatry.
Well, and you know that, you know, it is idolatry, and I think we discussed that in Germany in the Jewish problem, how the whole star concept, the stardom concept, is basically an invention of the Jew.
Well, it's right out of the Talmud. I saw a History Channel documentary. They asked a rabbi what he thought of the afterlife, and he said that the Jewish people have no concept of an afterlife. He said that if you've lived a good life worthy of remembrance, you will be remembered fondly by the Jewish people. That's their concept of an afterlife. Basically just idol worship or hero worship.
Bookshops distribute literature free in the villages. That's interesting. And in Moscow, it is sold very cheaply. No tickets are required for books.
Well, what sort of books?
Well, yeah, I'm sure it's all smut. Between 50 and 100 Englishmen are left in Moscow at this time. And I think this is 1919, but I'm not. This report, I'm scrolling back, this report was unclear. It's grouped with reports that, with other reports, like number 56 is dated, and that's March 23rd, 1919. And I'm assuming that 57 and 58 are, you know, placed after that, so they follow it. So
well, it can't be 1920 since the report came out in 1919.
Yes. Okay, then this has to be 1919. That's right. I'm sorry, I forgot that. We've been reading it so long, I forgot the title. Huh?
Right,
the title is 1919 is in the title.
All right, Mr. D, who has been in Russia for 3 or 4 years, left Moscow on 21st January. Mr. D was giving private lessons all the time he was in Russia, but during the last month or so, he went as a teacher of French to one of the lower grade schools in Moscow. The reason for this was that he found it practically impossible to live on the fourth category, and by going to a school, he was transferred to the third category. Discipline in the school, very bad indeed. The only reason why children or teachers went to school at all was in order to get the food supplied there. Food conditions were very bad indeed. No provision shops open in Moscow. The people are all anti-Bolshevik at heart, but they have to work for the Bolsheviks in order to live. Typhus is rampant, and many people are suffering from skin diseases. Mr. D himself experienced this, caused from the want of vats, only a few trams and trains running, and the former often have to stop for a day or two on account of disputes and strikes. The fuel question is very serious, and it has becoming more and more acute every day. Some friends of Mr. D had no means of cooking the little food they had, as they had no benzene, no kerosene, and no wood. People often have to cut up chairs, tables, etc. for firewood. Moscow is a dead city. Very few trams running. Many shops boarded up. All shop signs removed. The whole place looks deserted. The houses are all in bad condition. But in Mr. D's opinion, the streets of Moscow are much safer now than they were a year ago. There is no street robbery, and the only danger now is being arrested in the street. Mr. D thinks there are still about 60 or 70 English people left in Moscow. Bolshevik literature impresses the people to some extent, but they don't want to believe it. The people are waiting and hoping for some sort of intervention from England. The present position is intolerable, and practically anything would be preferable to Bolshevik rule. Isn't this a common theme that they're always waiting for intervention from either England, France, or the United States, but it's never coming?
It's never coming. And that's because the bankers in England, France, and the United States, at least in England and the United States, that they financed this.
They're not going to let it come.
They bought this. They bought, you know, Jacob Schiff bought this. And of course it's not going to come. The Rothschilds bought this. And of course it's not going to come. But the people are, you know, actually oblivious to that. Mr. E, secretary of a bank, left Russia on the 24th of January. He was interviewed at the Foreign Office on February 21st and supplied the following information. Economic conditions. It is impossible to live in Petrograd, as the prices are outrageous. There are only two categories now. of people that can get food. The first and the second. The first category consists of people working in the different Bolshevik works and organizations. Physical workers, their wives, and their children up to 12 years of age. The second category, I guess after 12 you're not a child anymore, huh? You could work probably. The
well,
second
that's
category,
the Jews say, isn't it?
Yeah, well, right. The second category consists of all those who either support themselves by their own labor, either mental or physical, and do not live by interest on accrued capital, or who do not use the fruits of other people's labor. The Red Guards are always considered first and practically form a category of their own, which is higher than either the first or the second. Officially, the first category ought to receive 1 pound of bread a day, and the second, a quarter pound. But in reality, the amount varies from day to day according to the supplies. The third and fourth categories have been done away with altogether. Consequently, there are a great many people who are in no category at all. The Bolsheviks published, so I guess you don't eat it all, huh? The Bolsheviks published statistics showing that the fourth category was not necessary, as there were so few members. Well, they were the capitalists. They were the bourgeois, and they killed most of them. So they don't need that category anymore. This proves that the fourth category people have either been exterminated or have been forced to work under the Bolsheviks in order to live. Well, they would have joined the first category then, eh? You move up in the world. 3 months ago, a decree was issued saying that all those about to enter the first category must produce a certificate from their trade organization. As a result of this decree, practically all the men joined a trade organization, and as every trade organization is controlled by the Bolsheviks in this way got more men under their power. The category people can only go to municipal shops. As a matter of fact, all other shops are closed. The latest prices of goods in Petrograd were bread. 1 ruble, 50 cents, I guess, parts of a ruble, a pound at a municipal shop. But 20 rubles a pound if bought outside from Red Guards, who were probably robbing the shops. Huh? Butter, 75 rubles a pound if bought outside. No fats of any description were sold at municipal shops. That would include butter. Sugar, which was only available about once a month, 1 ruble, 50 C, I'm going to call it cents, a pound at municipal shops, and otherwise 80 rubles. I think that's kopecks, actually. And otherwise 80 rubles. Meat was sometimes obtainable at the market. As a matter of fact, it was supposed to be sold by a card system, but it was generally sold in an underhand manner at the market. Beef, 23 rubles a pound. Veal, 26 rubles. Pork, 45 rubles. That's incredible. I guess all the pork was in the Kremlin, didn't they? Meat was also obtainable from the sack men. The Bolsheviks try to stop these sack men who go from house to house selling food. The category people do not get their supplies regularly or the full amount they are entitled to. The supply committee publishes in the paper from day to day what food is available and what each category is allotted. It's incredible. It's starvation in a land of plenty.
Financial situation. It is very difficult to draw any large amount of money out of a bank. And this has happened in the U.S. before, hasn't it? And it could easily happen again in this country. The Bolsheviks allow... Oh, sorry, go on.
Go on.
The Bolsheviks allow 1,000 rubles a month to be taken out from an account, but even this has become more difficult lately, as they have just issued a decree that a man must get either his house committee or some other Bolshevik organization to state that he is really in need of money. But by means of bribery, men draw out hundreds of thousands of rubles. All the banks have been nationalized, and now they are centralized. A decree was published a little while ago saying that if a man had an account in 3 or 4 banks, he must choose one bank and put all his money into that. If this decree was not obeyed, the Bolsheviks simply took all his money away. By this means, the Bolsheviks can tell exactly how much money each man has. If a new account was opened on the 1st January 1918, The depositor was allowed in principle to draw out his money freely, but in practice this was not so. When the banks were nationalized, new money could be taken out as desired, again only in principle. But when, about 6 weeks ago, the new decree about centralizing all accounts was published, the position of affairs was altered. For example, if a man had 5,000 rubles in his new account and 100,000 rubles in his old account, he could transfer his old account to his new account, so making 105,000 rubles in all. But according to this decree, he was only allowed to draw to the amount of 5,000 rubles, as the old account was considered barred. For transferring an account from one bank to another, the commissar is charged 25%.
Factories. There are frequent strikes in factories, which often have to be put down by force. About 6 weeks ago, there was a strike in the Putilov works. Trotsky, in a speech, made a definite threat to use force if the men did not go back. As a result of this, the strike was settled, with only a few arrests taking place. About 2 months ago, there was an election for the Workmen's Committee in the Putilov works, and this resulted in a majority for the Socialist Revolutionaries. The Bolsheviks would not consent to this, and there had to be another election. This shows that, in spite of the Workmen's Committees, the Bolsheviks are really in control. If the workmen get too independent, the government simply closes the factory down. And if the committee is troublesome, the same thing happens, unless a new committee is appointed. All members of the committee have to be communists or in sympathy with the communists. Often a factory has to close down for a lack of fuel or certain machinery, and the men who are thus thrown out of work are given an unemployment allowance. That's pretty soft.
House committees. Mr. E was a member of his house committee in order to get put into the second category. The chief duties of the house committee are to see that the different decrees of the Bolsheviks are carried out. If these are not carried out, the committee is held responsible and is either fined or imprisoned. The committee is forced to buy one newspaper a day in order to follow the decrees, as the Bolsheviks only publish their decrees in the newspaper. By this means, practically everyone has to read the papers, and as only Bolshevik papers are allowed to be published, their propaganda is seen by everyone.
General conditions. All the streets are deserted, and there is no life at all. The Nevsky is practically empty, whatever that is, and most of the shops are shut. I guess it's the avenue or something. But perfect order reigns in the streets. There is no looting or robbery. There are hardly any executions now. This is due to the fact that the people's spirit has been broken and that they now offer no opposition. All restaurants are closed, with the exception of municipal restaurants and cafes. In an ordinary cafe, a cup of tea without milk or sugar costs 1 ruble, and coffee, 3 rubles and 50 kopecks. Services still continue to be held in the churches, and on the whole, they are well attended. The congregation is chiefly composed of women, but on the Russian New Year's Eve, there were many men there. The priests, who used to be in the fourth category, are now in no category at all.
Intervention. In Mr. E's opinion, Allied intervention would be very welcome. He thinks 50,000 troops would be ample and that the Bolsheviks would not be able to rouse any opposition against us. In fact, the Red Guard officers would be among the first to join our ranks. Everybody is hoping and praying that the Allies will intervene and they would be welcomed with open arms everywhere. Of course,
that
never happened.
That tells me, you know, Mr. Ree is a British businessman reporting back, you know, to the British embassy after he returns from Russia. And that tells me that even the British businessmen did not realize the degree of control that the Jewish capitalists had over England and America, and probably didn't even realize that they financed the Bolshevik Revolution. In other words, even the educated class in Britain, who were familiar with Russia, they didn't have a clue as to what was going on. Finland. Russians crossing the border from Russia into Finland are now, in the majority of cases, sent back to Russia again, unless they have some very strong influence in Finland itself. Mr. F, who has returned from Vladimir, states that he had his factory going right up to the day of his departure from M on the 6th of February, M being the town. 1,100 poods of yarn daily, 800 pieces of cloth.
That was pre-revolution output, right?
Yes. The latest figures for January 1919 were 550 poods of yarn daily and 500 pieces of cloth. So it's down about 40%, 50%. 50%. Out of 6,500 workmen, there were not 200 convinced Bolsheviks. The majority were kept in order by pure terrorism, of which there were many examples within a radius of 40 versts of M, whatever a verst is, it's some unit of measure. When peasants refused to supply grain and cattle and rose to protest to protect their property, a Bolshevik force soon appeared in the neighborhood. And if any resistance was offered, the whole village was wiped out. Usually the peasants gave in at the first shot. A number of ringleaders would then be shot on the spot, and the number would be taken off to Moscow to prison.
Sounds like a mafia operation, doesn't it? They come through the neighborhood and demand their protection money, and if you don't pay up, they come back with more goons.
Right, it's absolutely a mafia operation.
Epidemic. Typhus is rapidly spreading in the country and the capitals. The average number of cases taken off trains arriving at the Kazan station, Moscow, is 20 per train. At the Kursk station in Moscow, typhus cases lie about the waiting halls. The hospitals are so full that patients are left in the corridor. So much for the Bolshevik national health care.
Well, right. And that's what people invite here. They don't... People... And it's amazing to me how well the propaganda was out of the Soviet Union and about the communist system for 40 years to train up generations of young communists in America that would embrace communist ideals and communist sympathies and have no idea what they were wrapping their arms around.
They were all useful idiots thinking they'd be getting a paradise on Earth when they'd probably wind up starving to death in some Bolshevik fortress.
Well, most of them, you know, even the Bolsheviks killed most of the non-Jews. The non-Jews that were their allies in their rise to power. They turned on them and killed them. They used them. They were useful goy for a few minutes, and then they just killed them.
You're referring to the genuine social progressives who actually wanted some sort of social reform.
Well, right. And sided up with the Bolsheviks, and when they were expended and used to the fullest, they got shot too.
And isn't that what Yuri Bezmenov said in the Soviet Subversion DVD that's available on your website? He said that the people that were genuinely seeking social change and reform, the progressives, the intellectuals, the liberals, he said that they become immediately offended with the communist regime, and they're usually the first victims.
Well, right. They just don't realize it. Well, I'm going to quote from the Bloody Red Streak again. Communism and Judaism are one and the same. Other similarities between communism and Judaism are hatred of Christianity. The Russian people, far from hating Christianity, are one of the most religious races on earth. Religious even to the point of superstition. The anti-Christian campaign in communist Russia is Jewish. The Jews have hated Christianity ever since they got Christ crucified by Pontius Pilate. Let us compare a communist or on Christianity with a Jew. The Soviet Education Commissar Lunacharsky defined the communist attitude to Christianity as follows. We hate Christianity and Christians. Even the best of them must be looked upon as our worst enemies. They preach the love of our neighbors and mercy, which is contrary to our principles. Christian love is an obstacle to the development of the revolution. Down with the love of our neighbors. What we want is hatred. We must learn how to hate, and it is only then that we shall conquer the world. Millionaire Hollywood Jew playwright Ben Hecht, who went wild with delight every time a British soldier was murdered in Palestine, writes on page 120 of his book, A Jew in Love, quote, "One of the finest things ever done by the mob was the crucifixion of Christ. Intellectually, it was a splendid gesture, but trust the mob to bungle. If I had had charge of executing Christ, I'd have handled it differently. You see, what I'd have done was have him shipped to Rome and fed to the lions. They could not have made a savior out of mincemeat. Do not be fooled by the Christianity of the communist dean of Canterbury, Dr. Hewlett Johnson. While Jewish hooligans were desecrating Christian churches and holy places in Jerusalem, Dr. Hewlett Johnson said in an interview he granted to the Jewish paper, Labor Israel, on the 6th of May, 1949, I do not think there is any ground for a claim that the whole city should be neutralized to safeguard Christian interests. I had much rather trust the Jews to look after them. I believe they would be the most honorable custodians." And that's the spineless Judeo-Christian attitude of today.
Absolutely. And I was going to point out, too, that we see what they're saying here. Hold on, I wanted to see where the quote was. Oh, they talk about wanting to conquer the world. He says it in explicit terms, that we are going to dominate and conquer the world. Yet we're always told that it was Hitler who wanted to conquer the world. The fascists, the nationalists, the racists, and the communists just wanted to improve their own nation, and they didn't want to impose their ideology on the outside world.
Every crime that they committed, they took and put off on Nazi Germany.
I mean, can you think of a single speech where Hitler said, we're going to take over the world?
No, there's absolutely no documentary evidence for that at all.
I've seen some documentaries on the History Channel, and they misquote Nazis as they would say that Hitler privately said, today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world. Yet I've never heard him say that in any of his speeches.
Not one. He wanted Lebensraum. And if you understand the history of Germany, you could understand why he wanted that. Because the German people, Germany in Strabo's time extended to the Black Sea. It was all considered Germany. And the Goths and the Scythians, who were the Saka, the Goths and the Scythians, inhabited all of that land.
Yes.
And they were all Germanic tribes.
But they were displaced and pushed west by the Huns and other Asiatics.
Yes, they were displaced and pushed west by Sarmatians, Huns, Mongols, all of the Asiatic tribes pushed them west, and the Slavic tribes pushed the Germanic tribes west. And Hitler only wanted to push back a little. That's all he wanted.
Well, Boxer, Buck and I have discussed this, and we've basically arrived at the conclusion that Stoddard and Grant have arrived at well before we have, that the answer to our racist problems has always been to retreat west. We originally populated Central Asia, Afghanistan, Persia, Egypt, into the Ukraine and whatnot, stretching all the way into the steppes of Asia. And as we came under pressure from the Asiatics, we simply would fall back westwards. And it ultimately took the form of sailing across the Atlantic Ocean to North America.
Well, right, but I see the sail across the ocean as an expansion and not a retreat. But you are right that we did retreat for many centuries. We retreated west, and we retreated when the Avars and the Huns came down the Danube. The Germanic people that dwelt around the Danube retreated north.
But I mean, if you think about it, as waves of Sicilians and East Europeans began flooding into this country in the second half of the 19th century, that's when a lot of genuinely white Americans, the Anglo-Americans, really started to move west in big numbers to get away from the East Coast cities. So it seems that our race, even in this country, has always moved west. You know, go west, young man.
Well, right. And that happened in when I was a kid in New Jersey. And most of the white families, and my father never wanted to leave, and he had a thriving business in the 60s, and he didn't want to go anywhere. But most of the white families fled Jersey City and went to the Poconos or down the shore. You know, it's that there was a big white flight out of the cities in the 60s and 70s.
And now there's nowhere to go now. And Stoddard put it that, you know, we've always looked east to face our Asian adversaries, and now for the first time, he was writing in 1920, we look west to face them across the great Pacific Ocean. And they've basically taken over our entire western seaboard without a shot being fired, just through demographic change.
Well, I'll read the last two parts of report number 57.
All right.
Sanitary conditions. In places where people congregate, such as railway stations, marketplaces, etc., the sanitary conditions are terrible. With the thawing of the snow, the epidemic, which has reached enormous proportions during winter frosts, will naturally increase in violence. Traffic. The Kazan Railway runs one passenger train each way to Kazan. This railway used to bring 40% of the food into Moscow. It now runs an average of three goods trains each way per day. The Red Army. No one wants to join the Red Army now except the worst elements of the people. If a conscript deserts in the town where he joins, his parents or wife are treated with extreme brutality, sometimes being shot. But desertion often takes place while troops are going to the front. Under these later circumstances, the Bolsheviks are unable to trace their relations, so they are not touched. Mr. F. considers one of the inducements to fight is that if the Red Army breaks through the enemy, it usually finds large stores of food. So they figure if they join the army and go to the front, they might get to eat if they win.
All right, shall we continue on the 58, or shall we save that for next week? Because 58 is pretty lengthy as well, as is 59.
Well, that's up to you.
If you want, I'm game for doing 58, and then we can call it a night after 58 if you want.
Okay.
All right. 58, the progress of Bolshevism in Russia. Memorandum of Bolshevism in Russia. I'm sorry, memorandum by Mr. B. on the progress of Bolshevism in Russia. The Russian government. There has now been time for considerable organization of the Bolshevik government. Russia has been divided into four federal republics. 1. Commune of the North. 2. Commune of the West. 3. Central Commune. 4. Commune of the Volga. The first is composed of the governments of Petrograd, Arkhangel, Vyatka, Volgoda, part of the government of Pskov, Novgorod, Tekerpovets, and Olenets. The second comprises the governments of Vitebsk, Smolensk, and Pskov. The third, the governments of Moscow, Orel, Kursk, Tula, Tver, Nizhny Novgorod, and Voronezh. The fourth, those of Kazan, Simbirsk, Saratov, and Perm. Each town is provided with its council of deputies and its commission for fighting counter-revolution, sabotage, and speculation. Each district besides has its council of deputies, Sovdep, and its extraordinary commission, that's the Cheka. These institutions direct all local affairs, but they are all subject to the authority of the Central Executive Committee, which sits at Moscow. The Pan-Russian Extraordinary Commission Against Counter-Revolution, etc., also sits at Moscow. The members of these bodies are supposed to be elected by the Pan-Russian Congress of Workmen, Peasants, Red Guards, Sailors, and Cossack deputies. Foreign affairs are under the exclusive management of George Chicherin. The Central Committee is composed as follows: President, Lenin, Military and Naval Commissary, Trotsky, Foreign Affairs, Chicherin, Commissary of Labor, Spies, Interior, Ex-Professor of History at Moscow, Podrovsky, Education, Lunatarsky, Commissary of Roads and Communication, former engineer at the Ministry, Nevsky, Lenin's wife, a social assistant, Ulanova, Minister of Justice, formerly a deputy of Petrograd Tribunal, Stuchka, Minister of Food, Tizupra, business manager named Bonch Brudovich. Would you like to read the next paragraph?
Yeah, I'll read the next paragraph. I'm looking at this rulers of Russia. And in 1917, he gives a list. This is Rules of Russia is written in 1938 by the Reverend Dennis Fahey, back when reverends had spines, I guess, and would identify the Jew. And identify the Jew for what he was, because that's what Dennis Fahey did. And he named, he lists the 20, the maybe two dozen top officers of the Soviet in 1917. And the only one he says was Russian is Lenin. And there is evidence that Lenin's mother was Jewish.
Wikipedia even lists him as part Jewish.
Yes. And Fahey lists him as Russian. But he lists every other single Russian leader as being Jewish. I'm not going to read them, but I just thought I'd mention that. And we have other sources here also. The Red Army. On the 25th of October, 1918, the Bolshevik troops of Petrograd and the neighborhood numbered hardly more than two divisions. Regimental committees had been abolished throughout the army, and the power was transferred to military commissaries who were charged with attending to the political morale. The Bolsheviks have neglected no means for increasing the number of their troops. Disabled soldiers of the old army released from Germany are concentrated on arrival either at Petrograd or Moscow and quartered with soldiers of the Red Guard. They are left without clothing, with insufficient rations, without medical attendance, while the Red Guard with whom they are mingled is well-fed, clothed, and amply supplied with money. When they complain, the answer is, enroll in the Red Guard. Refractory cases are cruelly treated. So I guess they had not much choice, huh? At the head of the Red Guard is a former colonel of the staff, a Lithuanian, named Vitatis. Each soldier receives 300 to 500 rubles a month. Equipment, food on a higher scale than all the other categories, and a promise to support his family in the event of death. But in spite of their privileged situation, the Red Guard have not the confidence of the government, and as intercepted letters show, many of them are disaffected. The real reliance of the government is placed in the international battalions of the army, which are formed of Lithuanians and Chinese, who are used as punitive companies both in the army and in the interior. Theoretically, so this is basically an alien invading force with foreign mercenaries that took Russia over. That's what it boils down to. Theoretically, the international battalions are on an equality with the Red Guard, but actually they are far better paid, and they can count on absolute immunity for the excesses they commit against the wretched civil population, which is at their mercy. There is compulsory military instruction in the towns for all men between 17 and 40 in the form of drills twice a week. While its cohesion lasts, the Bolshevik army is an incontestable force, in Russia,
right,
at least.
The terror. All assemblies except those organized by the Bolsheviks are forbidden in the towns. Anti-Bolshevik meetings are dispersed by armed force and their organizers shot. No press exists except the Bolshevik press. The Bolsheviks organize Sunday reunions in which such subjects as should one enroll in the Red Guards and who will give us our daily bread, the world revolution, etc., are debated. Now, doesn't this sound, we have a softer version of this today in the United States, wouldn't you say, with the ARA disrupting all meetings and physically attacking and assaulting organizers, trying to out them and cost them their jobs so they can't get their daily bread?
Absolutely not.
So effective is the terror that no one dares to engage in anti-Bolshevik propaganda. People have been arrested for a simple telephone conversation in which the term seemed ambiguous or could be interpreted as adverse to the Bolsheviks. An arrest is the prelude to every kind of corruption. The rich have to pay huge exactions to intermediaries who are usually Jews before they can obtain their release.
I wonder if they will, if the American government was listening in on phone conversations at this early time.
Latterly, mass arrests have come into fashion. It was thought at first that these were ordered by the Extraordinary Commission Against Counter-Revolution, but it is now known that they were ordered by a special revolutionary committee called for short the Three. because it consists of three members. This committee is independent of the Extraordinary Commission and is controlled only by the Commissary of War. Persons arrested by its orders have never been seen again. The proceedings of this committee are kept secret. Its very composition is unknown to the public. Well, my guess is it's three Jews. What would you guess?
I would think it was three Jews.
It has already been mentioned that the Red Guard is disaffected. A letter from a sailor named Barzov, written on the eve of going to the front, says, quote, "The authorities seem to think that we are going to support the interests of the Soviets, but they are greatly mistaken. All the sailors are otherwise inclined. Many of them go simply to avoid hunger. I think there will be an end to all this very soon. The Allies will overpower us." Another letter from Petrograd says, quote, "We hear that Petrograd, before any other Russian town, will be in touch with Europe, but in the meantime, half the inhabitants there are dying from hunger and typhoid fever." These letters and others were sent by the Russian censor to the Extraordinary Commission for Fighting the Counter-Revolution, and no doubt the writers have already been dealt with in the usual way. There is, of course, in Russia, a public opinion quite outside the Bolsheviks, an opinion which longs ardently for any kind of intervention, Allied or German, which will put an end to the present state of anarchy. So far, it has expressed itself only in half-hearted insurrections, as, for example, that of Yaroslav and the assassination of Murbach, etc. Nevertheless, in spite of the apparent stability of the Bolshevik government, in spite of the ineptitude of its opponents, there are signs that the terrorist oligarchy is tottering. It is indeed impossible to believe that a government financially bankrupt and unable to feed its population can survive for very long, however drastically it attempts to govern by terror. A neutral in Petrograd said recently that hatred towards the government and everybody connected with it is spreading among all classes of the population, including peasants and working men. The end will probably come quite suddenly, as it did in the French Terror. The anti-Bolshevik parties are considering all sorts of devices for discrediting the Bolsheviks. One is to flood the country with false currency in order to throw discredit on the Soviets. Another to seize the printing office where banknotes are produced at Petrograd. Another to obtain employment in government offices for the purpose of furnishing information to their party, which is being conducted by Boris Asfenkov. Even the working classes of the two capitals is divided, and there is a considerable anti-Bolshevik party. The general opinion of the educated classes is that a force of 500,000 would suffice to overthrow the Bolsheviks with very few losses. Would you like to take the Bolshevik administration?
Bolshevik administration. One is startled from time to time by hearing that some well-known man of education has joined the Bolsheviks, because they have no food otherwise. For instance, as Maxim Gorky and the famed singer Chaliapin. The fact is that there are many specious things in the Bolshevik creed designed to capture persons of all shades of opinion. It is not usually with the principles of a system of government that fault can be found, but in the application of the principles. And when these apply by ruffians, such as the terrorists of the French and the Russian revolutions, the principles fall into ruin. Rose-colored accounts of the Bolshevik regime are written by persons who have only the principles to go by. Take, for example, the housing question. Some families have more rooms than they can live in. Others have to live in one room. Others, again, have no room at all. The Bolshevik government commandeers a large house and lets it to indigent persons so that all have equal housing accommodation. The house is managed by a committee, and the only person who dislikes the arrangement is the owner of the house. The rationing is another instance. There are four categories. Number one entitles those engaged in heavy manual work to 3/4 of a pound of bread and 5 herrings a day. And number four, the lowest in the scale, giving in fact the right to 1/6 of a pound of bread per day, is prescribed for those who employ other people. Number four is a very cogent weapon for persuading people to enlist in a Red Guard or other unpopular occupation. National economy is managed by a superior council sitting at Moscow, which nominally administers the industry exports and imports for the whole country. But in practice, all industry and commerce being paralyzed, It has very little to do. There is food administration in each district, partly under the control of the Food Commissariat and partly under the Council of National Economy. Expeditionary Corps, composed of volunteers and Red Guards, are used to requisition corn from the peasants, who will not give it willingly because the price is fixed at a lower rate than the cost of production. These expeditionary corps carry away all the food on which they can lay their hands, leaving the peasants what is strictly necessary. It is, in fact, a kind of organized brigandage. Corps of the same kind exist in the mills and factories with not less than 1,000 employees. The requisition for the food necessary for the maintenance of themselves and the factory hands. Much is made among the Bolshevik sympathizers in England of the Bolshevik system of public education. And the same thing here. We have a Bolshevik educational system here, and it's still Bolshevik. But it is easy to acquire merit for any educational system in a country where there was practically no elementary education before the revolution. Now, we saw that that's totally false.
Yes.
This Englishman buys the propaganda. I don't know. It's Michael Raphael Johnson refutes that. It is also true that the opera and the theaters are kept running, but I am assured that the opera performed to an empty house until the government gave order that it was to be filled.
So if people won't go see the Jewish performance, the local Jewish commissars say, "Hey, my cousin's putting on a play. You better be there."
Such methods of window dressing are not unknown in other countries. The following is a list of prices for foodstuff and clothing on the 15th, current on the 15th of December, and that must be 1918. Potatoes, mostly rotten, 10 rubles per pound. That was up from 6 rubles per pound the summer before. Salt fish, bad condition, 9 to 10 rubles per pound. Bread, by card, scarce, 1.5 rubles per pound. That's cheaper than before. Bread in open market, 18 to 20 rubles per pound. Pork, scarce, 50 rubles per pound. Those prices are way up. Beef, scarce, 22 to 23 rubles per pound. Sugar, scarce, 80 rubles per pound. Tea, scarce, 100 rubles per pound. Coffee, none to be had at any price. Butter, salted, 75 rubles per pound. That's cheaper. Butter, unsalted, 80 rubles per pound. The Russian pound is 2 ounces lighter than the English pound. Well, once the Jews got a hold of it, probably. Suit of clothes, very ordinary, 800 to 900 rubles. A pair of shoes, poor quality, 400 rubles. Cotton, only by card, for a 26-inch square, 15 to 16 rubles. Other reports show that Bolshevism is still a potent force in Siberia and that Bolsheviks are in close touch with those in European Russia. In destroying the fabric of society, the Bolsheviks appear to be adopting the methods of skyscrapers in New York, which is to dig out everything to a depth of 300 feet in order to erect a new and stable edifice. In other words, he's saying that they're destroying the whole country to supposedly build a better building on top of it. They have said more than once that unless they can by propaganda induce a sympathetic revolution in other countries, their fate must be sealed, and the fever of propaganda which now possesses them is really a measure of self-preservation. Well, they induced that propaganda here in America and in the West, didn't they?
Mainly in Germany, didn't they?
Well, yeah, in Germany too, but I mean in America, I mean Uncle Joe was the greatest. I mean in the 1930s, there's nothing bad written about Russia or in the media concerning the Soviets.
Who's going to write it? Most of the writers are Jews. Who's going to publish it? Almost all the publishers are Jews.
That's my point. They certainly affected that propaganda here to the effect that they won American sympathy for them in World War II. It is now reported they are abandoning propaganda by leaflets in favor of personal and secret propaganda.
All right.
That's the end of report number 58.
Shall we pick up with 59 next weekend then?
Yes, we should.
All right, great. Well, I think we've covered quite a bit, and people will see what happens when we get on to 59, and 59 is a fairly lengthy report, but we've already established that the Russian economy was vibrant – before the revolution. They had solid infrastructure. Their industry was expanding in all sectors, and they had a fairly large educational system, didn't they? They had access to all sorts of advanced institutions. Innovation was booming in Russia, and the Bolshevik Revolution brought that to a standstill, not due to the civil war that resulted, but due to the fact that the Bolsheviks basically destroyed the entire country.
Yes, it did. And 59 is interesting because it's going to cover Bolshevism abroad. And we're going to also see that in some of this auxiliary material I've been citing.
Excellent. And particularly the portrayal of Bolshevism in America. It even gets so bad that you have President Woodrow Wilson saying that the Bolsheviks would be a partner fit to sit at the League of Honor next to the United States. He said that what was happening in Russia was it was welcoming and heartwarming. I believe those are the words he used. Do you recall the quote?
Not offhand, no. I'm sorry.
All right, but we can get into that next week, and I'll find the exact quote.
Absolutely.
Right,
and tonight I'm going to post a movie to the Mein Kampf site, The Eternal Jew. It's in German, but it has English narration.
All right.
And some English subtitles.
All right, then. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Yahweh bless.
God bless.